iTunes and all of the digital platforms.
So the show is again Tuesday, October 29th at 7:30 p.m. at the First Congressional UCC here in Portland. There are still tickets available.
Yeah, you can go to simritkarmusic.com to buy tickets.
Spelled S-I-M-R-I-T-K-A-U-R.
It's going to be a really beautiful show. It's going to be super fun, and we're really looking forward to it. It's a beautiful venue with a gorgeous pipe organ, and yeah, I'm really excited about it. Thank you so much for having me today.
Thank you, and we will see you Tuesday, October 29th at 7:30 p.m., First Congressional UCC.
Awesome. See you there.
You're listening to KBOO KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Next up is Preference with your host, Hedda.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Dia de los Muertos on Wednesday, October 30th from 4 to 9 p.m. at Irving Street Studio in Portland. Educata Ya hosts Dia de los Muertos featuring decorative altars, people dressed up as Katrinas, reading of the satirical Calaveras, and a traditional Pan de Muerto. Again, that's Dia de los Muertos on Wednesday, October 30th from 4 to 9 p.m. at Irving Street Studios, 721 Northwest 9th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO proudly co-sponsors the Portland Folk Music Society concert series, featuring a special appearance by Radim Zenkel. The show is Friday, November 1st, 7:30 p.m. at the Reedwood Friends Church in Southeast Portland. Radim Zenkel created what he calls Zenkel-style mandolin, where his single instrument can sound like two. He plays his native Czech music, along with bluegrass, classical, jazz, and much more. He was named U.S. Mandolin Champion in 1992. For more information about the Portland Folk Music Society concert series, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to Preference, dear listeners. I'm your host, Hedda. That was Spacer by Sheila and B. Devotion. 40 years since that song came out. Maybe I'll be able to get Sheila on the line to celebrate with us sometime soon. If any of you know her, please let her know. I'd love to have her on the radio. This is Preference. We're part of the QT Boo slot here on the station. The slot is between 6 and 7 every Tuesday. We have queer and trans stories about self, about the world, a rotating cast of programs and hosts and guests, of course. And you, our listeners, who make this community radio station possible. So we thank you very much. Remind you that our station's used books and music sale is coming up in November. Head to KBOO's website and check out the information on that. It's a couple weeks on a Saturday, I believe the 21st. On the line, we have Pauline Park. Pauline, can you hear us?
I can, Alan. Can you hear me?
Yes, indeed. Welcome so much to Preference. We're happy to have you back.
I'm delighted to be back.
Do you want to introduce yourself to our listeners?
Sure. I am the chair of NIAGRA, the New York Association for Gender Rights Advocacy, and president of the board of directors of Queens Pride House, the LGBT Community Center of the Borough of Queens, where I am also the coordinator of the Transgender Support Group. I'm also a co-founding member of New York City Queers Against Israeli Apartheid, and have been involved with a number of different organizations and legislative campaigns. I suppose I'm best known here in New York for having led the campaign for the New York City transgender rights law that was enacted by the City Council back in 2002.
Wonderful. Thanks for that. We've talked in the past on Preference about queer solidarity with Palestinians.
Yes. And there's much to talk about there, both locally and nationally and indeed internationally. And I think we're at a rather crucial turning point in that story on a variety of levels. First, because as some of your listeners might have heard, Benjamin Netanyahu, the longest serving prime minister in the history of Israel, has seemingly reached a dead end, unable to form a new government after the latest election. So it's a very much an open question what will transpire, but it is possible that he may be indicted on corruption charges, may end up behind bars, although I think actually what he deserves is to be taken to The Hague to be tried on war crimes charges by the International Criminal Court, though that's unfortunately not likely to happen. And at another level, I think it's of real importance to the LGBT community, first of all because there are queer Palestinians living under the occupation who get no special pink card or rainbow card that exempts them from all the human rights violations committed by apartheid Israel and illegally occupied Palestine. And secondly, because pinkwashing is actually one of the last tools that Zionists still have to try to use to justify the illegal occupation of Palestine by diverting attention to what is supposedly a good record on LGBT issues in Israel, and even that record is debatable. But certainly the question of the occupation has to be central when we discuss LGBT Palestinians as well as LGBT Israelis and the queer community more generally.
What's your sense of where, well, what a post Netanyahu Israeli government might look like, and in particular on this topic of the occupation?
Well, there are only two likely alternatives. Benny Gantz with blue and white, who is likely not to be much better than Netanyahu. He himself is a war criminal and has taken part in, directly participated in, various episodes of the ongoing genocide in Gaza. Avigdor Lieberman, who's even worse, arguably worse than Netanyahu and worse than Gantz, who is basically the leader of the secular right in Israel, who has the third largest number of seats, who is even more Zionist, although he doesn't lead the religious parties. So I think the short term, unfortunately, I have to say, looks very bad for the Palestinian people, particularly the indigenous Palestinians of Gaza, who are under an illegal blockade of over a decade long now that is an incremental genocide, as the noted Israeli historian Ilan Pape calls it. I think the long term is really something like a South African trajectory. And that's really due in good part to BDS and the fact that the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement is having a real impact. It's funny that Zionists love to ridicule it and say it's been a complete failure. If that's so, why is the Israeli government spending over $80 million trying to discredit the BDS movement? I think what's really significant, and here, to be absolutely clear, it's the United States which holds most of the cards here, because Israel could not continue to maintain this horrendous occupation without the support of the U.S. government, which it's had fairly consistently over the last half century, whether it's been a Democrat or Republican in office. And in fact, Barack Obama handed Netanyahu a $38 billion check on his way out of office to help sustain the occupation for another decade. But the real change is on the ground here in the U.S., which is there is a real shift going on in the Democratic Party. I also think in the Jewish community. I think I was talking to one friend and colleague of mine in the movement, an anti-Zionist Jewish BDS activist, and she said, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, it was hard to get any attention to BDS, let alone the occupation, and let alone the LGBT aspect of it. Now, things are really shifting. And I feel that shift myself, even here in New York. I live in the 14th District and voted for Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, both in the primary last June and then in the general election in November. And the primary was the biggest shock of the year, not just New York, but nationally, unseating Joe Crowley, the Queens County Democratic Party boss, who was widely thought to be Nancy Pelosi's successor as speaker. So AOC's victory actually had national and potentially international repercussions. Also, the election of Ilhan Omar in Minnesota, and the election of Rashida Tlaib, who is, of course, the first Palestinian elected to Congress from the Detroit area. I hate to say it, but Ayanna Pressley, who's the fourth member of what's become known as the Squad, is a Zionist and is an enormous disappointment with regard to Israel-Palestine, even if she's somewhat more progressive on other issues. She's what, here in New York, we call a PEEP, progressive on everything except for Palestine. And the PEEPs are not my PEEPs. So, and that's an extremely common phenomenon here in New York, actually, because the city has an almost permanent Democratic majority in the city council, same for the New York State Assembly. And so what really, frankly, differentiates the true progressives from the phony progressives, what separates the sheep from the goats, is as Midwesterners might say, although I actually love goats as much as sheep, is in fact their willingness to, frankly, stand up to the Zionist machine and to take on apartheid Israel.
How do you think Zionism annexes itself in politics in the U.S.?
I think that it happens in a number of different ways and on a number of different levels. But it's interesting because it's, to me, it strikes me as a kind of a tail wagging the dog situation. Because the reality is that even though there are those who argue that Israel is an asset to the U.S. and the Middle East, I actually don't think that's the case. Even in a very mainstream kind of analysis, it's really the U.S. that's the asset to Israel by funding the occupation and by insulating it from accountability in international fora, including the UN. The U.S. uses its veto in the UN Security Council to quash any attempt to hold Israel accountable, the same for other international fora. And so, frankly, U.S. foreign policy is oriented towards supporting Israel's objectives in occupied Palestine and throughout the Middle East.
How much of a chance do you think there is? Well, not chance, that's the wrong word. What kind of momentum is there for tackling Zionism, or these peeps, in the New York area or New York State?
I think there's real momentum now. It's belied by the fact that we have a very Zionist governor, Andrew Cuomo, a very Zionist mayor, Bill de Blasio, who fell flat on his face in his presidential run, couldn't get over 0%, and withdrew. The fact is, in the last 8 years, nearly 9 years now that I've been involved with Palestine Solidarity Organizing, there's really been a kind of a sea change. Because when we started this work through New York City Queers Against Israeli Apartheid back in the spring of 2011, it was incredibly difficult to get any attention on the issue, including and especially in the LGBT community, let alone a sympathetic hearing. I think what changed that, there were a few things that changed that. Some were local, but really the big factors were national and international. The re-election of Netanyahu, the election of Donald Trump, the close association between Trump and Netanyahu, certainly the Gaza genocide in 2014. These were major factors that shifted the image of Israel and really made it more difficult. And in fact, no less a luminary on the right than Frank Luntz, possibly the most famous Republican pollster in the country, secretly did a public opinion survey for a number of different organizations, Zionist organizations, including ADL, that found that that Israel was losing young Jewish Americans and also losing Democrats. And so there has been a real shift, which we see on the national level. Presidential candidates for the first time are starting to really shift in the way they talk about this. Just a few. Bernie Sanders has certainly had of everyone else, but Elizabeth Warren and Pete Buttigieg have made comments suggesting that they might actually condition aid to Israel based on human rights considerations. At the local level, we have Jewish Voice for Peace, a national organization with whom I work very closely in QAIA, has its national office in Manhattan, but also a very vibrant local chapter, its largest local chapter, and many other organizations here, If Not Now is another one, Adala New York. There's been, in the last 10 or 11 years, just since I got involved with Palestine Solidarity Work, a kind of a real synergy and coming together. And so even though there's our elected officials, Democrats as well as Republicans, are kind of lagging indicators here on this as on so many other issues. You can see it when AOC, she only made one comment critical of the occupation during the primary season, but it was the first time any candidate for Congress from the state of New York had made any comment remotely critical of the occupation or of Israel, but she won the primary handily. And the same thing is happening in other races. Now, the Justice Democrats, who are the folks who helped elect AOC, are working on primary challenges to other local electeds, including Elia Engel, who represents part of Westchester County and part of the Bronx, who is one of the most stridently Zionist members of Congress. And so you see this happening on the local level. You see it at the state level, on the national level. It was interesting because the New York State Legislature was moving to pass an anti-BDS bill. It actually passed one of the houses, but not both houses of the state legislature. But Andrew Cuomo wanted credit for attacking BDS, and did so with what I think is an unconstitutional executive order that essentially criminalized BDS under state law through his executive order, which is being challenged by the NYCLU, the New York Civil Liberties Union, in court. But that did not go unremarked, and in fact, I participated in march from the Mount Kisco station, train station, to the governor's house mansion, a few miles away, after he signed the executive order. So things are really happening. Things are happening on the local level. It is now becoming a little bit more, not mainstream, but it is certainly more politically possible to be anti-Zionist and a candidate for office. At Queens Pride House, I organized the first public forum on the pinkwashing of Israeli occupation and apartheid at any LGBT community center in the city, possibly in the country, ever, back in June 2013. It's hard to believe that was 6 years ago. And with Sarah Shulman, the noted Jewish lesbian anti-Zionist activist and writer, and professor at the College of Staten Island CUNY, we held a forum discussing the occupation and the pinkwashing of the occupation, the LGBT queer community's responsibility to stand with our Palestinian brethren and sisters living under the occupation. That was, interestingly enough, what prompted the publisher of the Queens Chronicle, which is a leading weekly paper in the borough of Queens, to attack Queens Pride House in an editorial, in fact, me by name. I'm now officially an enemy of the state of Israel, apparently. And that was a signal moment, I think. I organized that noting at the forum that Queens Pride House as an organization did not take a position on the underlying issue of Israel-Palestine. However, our position in favor of free speech and in favor of open discussion of Israel-Palestine was articulated through the organizing of this forum. And you would not believe the backlash we got, perhaps you might, from Zionists, and especially gay Zionists, frankly, when I organized this forum. People trying to push me to invite the Israeli Consul General, or someone from AIPAC, or at least someone from J Street. It was really quite extraordinary, but we made the point, and it was an important one to make. And it's probably no coincidence And no surprise that no LGBT community center anywhere in the country, as far as I'm aware, since then, before or since, has held a forum, has sponsored, organized a forum on this, as opposed to hosting it. The LGBT Community Center in Manhattan, QAIA held a forum at the center in Manhattan, but it was simply a space rental situation. They weren't sponsoring it or co-sponsoring it or hosting it in any other respect. And of course, this has so much to do with funding and people being afraid of what would happen if they spoke out on this issue.
We're chatting with Pauline Park. Pauline, do you think that there's... Do you think that space within the Democratic Party has opened up for more thoughtful considerations of Israel and the Palestinian occupation? Do you think that that space is closing at the same time among Republicans?
Well, this is actually, interestingly enough, the Zionist fear, because for the last half century, Israel has been a bipartisan issue in that Democrats have been, if I may put it so bluntly, as complicit in the occupation as Republicans. And now that there's a real shift going on at the base level, not the leadership, not the DNC, not the level of the Clintons, but or the Bidens, but at the base level, among activists, especially progressives in the party, there is, in fact, that possibility, and Zionists have been quietly and in some cases occasionally openly wringing their hands about it, because if it becomes a partisan issue, then there's a possibility that it would become a Republican issue. Supporting Israel would become the Republican thing. It's already becoming very closely associated with Trump because of his policies, because of Jared Kushner's role, etc., etc., etc. And that's their great fear, because without the Democrats on board, then it becomes a kind of a political football. And the reality is there are more Democrats in the U.S. than there are Republicans. And so it becomes potentially a losing issue for Zionist Democrats. Oh, we're not there yet, and we won't be there for a while. However, we are moving in that direction, and that is a good thing. And that's because of pressure from outside the system, from outside the establishment, from various sources within the Democratic Party, within the Jewish community, within the LGBT community, and obviously from Palestinian Arab Muslim Americans, as well as others, and progressives and human rights activists. And honestly, it should be the occupation should be an issue for everyone, because an injury to one is an injury to all, as the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King would say. And so I think we're seeing a sea change now, and it's happening maybe in slow-mo, but actually faster than some might have thought. And it also goes with a larger reappraisal within the Democratic Party of the policies of the establishment for the last 30 or 40 years, certainly from the Clinton administration onwards, but arguably, in some respects, frankly, starting with the Carter administration, neoliberalism in particular, and the centrism that has dominated Democratic Party politics really from arguably from 1976 to the present day, which is 43 years. But certainly with regards to foreign policy. I think there are other things that have been happening that have advanced this. One, which may not directly implicate Israel, but certainly does indirectly, was the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, the Saudi journalist who was writing for the Washington Post and murdered and dismembered on the orders of the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman. MBS was not just a key, he was the key to the so-called deal of the century that has yet to be fully unveiled, which was Jared Kushner's plan to bring some sort of permanent settlement, although of course it's no such thing. It's really basically a way to try to bribe the Palestinians into submission using Saudi oil money. And the fact that the murder of MBS has discredited him in many circles, and frankly should do so universally, has been a serious impediment to movement forward with this so-called deal of the century. The other impediment being the Israeli elections. But the reality is, no one is going to accept that kind of agreement, that kind of resolution, because it's no resolution at all. And of course, the Palestinian Authority is, to all intents and purposes, now nothing but an instrument, a tool, an arm of the occupation. And I think what we need to do, the two big revelations coming out of my participation in the first U.S. LGBTQ delegation tour of Palestine, one was the extent to which no one over there talks about the two-state solution. The two-state solution is dead. Netanyahu killed it. The choice now is between a permanent apartheid occupation regime and one democratic state. Hashtag one democratic state in Israel-Palestine. The other big revelation was the extent to which the Palestinian Authority has lost all credibility with the Palestinians of the West Bank. And so, at this point, frankly, the reality is Palestinians have gained virtually nothing from the Oslo Accords and lost practically everything. The occupation, the de facto annexation has proceeded apace since the Oslo Accords, with more and more land being gobbled up by illegal Israeli settlements. And I think the fact that people, including prominent people in the LGBT community, are getting pushback for their participation in pinkwashing and or brand Israel branding shows that things are changing. Demi Lovato, who is not someone I'm a fan of or followed in any way, but she's a name, and she got a huge amount of pushback from people for essentially going on a paid junket. And she ended up deleting all of her tweets about what a great time she had bathing in the Jordan River. And that might not have happened 10 years ago. So I think we're making progress there. And I think, obviously, the congressional and presidential elections next year will be pretty crucial. And who the Democrats nominate will be crucial. I have among my progressive friends, they've really kind of split down the middle between Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. On the issue of Israel-Palestine, there's simply no comparison. Bernie isn't where he needs to be. He's actually quite far from where he needs to be. But he's way ahead of everyone else. Elizabeth Warren has just made the first tentative steps to criticizing the occupation. They're all still talking about the two-state solution, but the others aren't really worth considering, not only because of Israel-Palestine, but for every other issue as well. And so among those the two progressive candidates, there's no question in my mind who's stronger. I might add tangentially the fact that Bernie is Jewish, the fact that he'd be the first Jewish Democratic presidential nominee, and let's hope the first Jewish president elected in the United States, would be really a signal of importance because of his progressive policy agenda and the fact that he has gone some ways, not nearly as far as he needs to, in talking about the Israeli occupation of Palestine. He needs to move off. He needs to get real about the two-state solution and realize the two-state solution is dead. But he's come along. He's gone further than any other major party viable presidential candidate in history on that issue.
You referred to support for Israel as a political football, which I'd like to simplify that even more and say that in a sense the whole question of support for Israel by the U.S. government is now political in a way that it wasn't before. It's a topic that has been introduced for political debate, whereas by and large it wasn't something that people gave a lot of thought to. There's sort of a quiet or passive assent from almost all of us, I think, for that support. It just seemed like the way things were, what we do. And now it is political in a way that in a way that we can watch, I think, this this topic become part of our debate about who we are and what we want to be.
Yes, certainly. And I think it's crucial because it really does, to my mind, indicate who has the courage of their convictions. Anyone can say they're progressive, and there are a hell of a lot of funny progressives out there, including our governor and mayor, as I mentioned before. I think that Palestine is the true test, because it means taking on the entire political establishment and the Zionist machine. It means taking on, frankly, the Democratic Party as well as the Republican Party as well as the current administration and the permanent foreign policy establishment and chunks of academia, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think that it ends up being a far greater test. I mean, maybe 20 years ago, 25 years ago, being pro-LGBT might have been that test. Maybe 10 years ago, being in favor of same-sex marriage might have been that test, maybe. Although I think marriage equality is a kind of a special case in some ways. But that being said, in the Democratic Party, being pro-LGBT is de rigueur. In most parts of the country, it would be actually difficult to win a Democratic Party primary if you weren't at least nominally pro-LGBT. And same-sex marriage is basically settled law now, and I don't think the Supreme Court will overturn it. And so other issues come to the fore. And we can talk about those issues. But ultimately, I think that we have to bring to bear an intersectional analysis that incorporates progressive feminist values and human rights into policy at all levels, foreign policy, domestic policy. And Israel-Palestine is a crucial part of that mix, as is support for democracy more generally. I could go on about the failures of every administration for the last half century, including the Democratic administrations, on all these issues, a whole range of issues. It was Democratic administrations, it was the Clinton administration that really spearheaded the mass incarceration of people of color. And Barack Obama was called the deporter-in-chief by La Raza for having deported more immigrants than any other president in history. And he also dropped more bombs and killed more people with drone strikes, most of them innocent people of color, in Afghanistan and Pakistan than any other president in history. So all these things, I think, need to be taken into account in a holistic approach to politics that doesn't make exceptions for Israel. It's funny that Zionists talk about the Israel exception as if people single out Israel for criticism and condemnation. It's actually quite the opposite. The Israel exception is exempting Israel from scrutiny, let alone from accountability. That's the real Israel exception. And so we have to look holistically at everything that government does, and society for that matter, and move forward to advance an agenda of progressive transformational change. I think that also has to involve economic policy. I have to say, and of course, everything that I'm saying here, I'm speaking in an individual capacity, not on behalf of either Niagara or Queens Pride House or any other organization with which I'm associated. That being said, I have to say the reason why I am burning or bust is because when I hear Elizabeth Warren talk about change, she's talking about small incremental changes. Someone who says, I'm a capitalist to my bones, someone who says, I love markets, someone who basically says, we just need to regulate markets better, isn't getting it. We need transformational change, social, economic, and political. And simply tinkering with the existing system is not enough. We're on the verge of a cataclysm here with the climate crisis. Some scientists have determined that we may have a dozen years before global warming becomes irreversible. That's a blink of an eye. And politically, it's really difficult to get any change done. And so what we need is radical transformational change. And simply instituting, promulgating some new regulations and instituting minor incremental change around the margins is not going to save us. It's not going to save our country. It's not going to save the world. It's not going to save the planet. We need to think big. We need to think globally and act locally. We need to take seriously the warnings of scientists, of Greta Thunberg, and others who are pointing out the looming catastrophe in our climate, and really move towards radical and transformational change at all levels. And I think that on a queer note here, since this is an LGBT queer program, we need to avoid the bourgeois assimilationism of HRC-dom, the incredibly inaptly named human rights campaign, which actually doesn't really support human rights for most people. We need to jettison the politics of respectability, because ultimately it's not about, as I see it, mainstreaming our sexuality and gender identity. It's about transforming the way society understands both sexual orientation and gender identity, but also transforming the way society does business at every level. I mean, here in New York, for example, as I'm sure is probably sadly true in Portland and certainly every other city in this country, we have a crisis in homelessness. And many of those homeless people are LGBT, many are queer youth. And so all these things relate. We had a really important election in Queens that took place earlier this year. We had a queer Latina, Tiffany Caban, who I endorsed and voted for and supported, running for district attorney of Queens County, which is a tremendously powerful position. It's actually arguably the most powerful elective office in the borough. And she was challenging the machine. The machine candidate was the Queensborough president, the current, the outgoing Queensborough president, Melinda Katz, who, if I may make a pun here, is the cat's paw of the real estate industry, who's notorious for taking money from developers and doing their bidding. And on primary night, it appeared that Tiffany Caban narrowly won. But Melinda Katz and her people, the Queens Machine, the Queens County Democratic Party organization, challenged ballots in court, and Melinda ended up winning by 16 votes.
Mm.
Not 16%. We're talking about a dozen and a half people. We're talking about, you know, 16 people. Mainly because the judge who presided over the case invalidated ballots for really very ridiculous and trivial reasons. Invalidated enough ballots cast by people who voted for Tiffany Caban to enable Melinda Katz to win. And it was really, I mean, technically, of course, there's a general election in a week, but the Republican has no chance. No one expects a Republican to even get 20%. And so this is an example of what goes on in this county, in the borough of Queens, and in the city. One-party rule. I have friends who say, oh, you know, I have one friend who says, when in doubt, vote for the Democrat. Well, in fact, that's what people do in New York, and we get really bad government because of it. We have a ballot measure, which is actually surprising to me. It's very exciting, and I'm going to vote for it, for ranked choice voting. And ranked choice voting, if enough voters vote for it, that would be a revision to the city charter, which is the constitution of the city of New York, which could actually seriously dent the power of the party bosses. And that would be a really good thing. I personally favor nonpartisan municipal elections because the parties, especially the Democratic Party, but the Democratic and Republican parties in this city actually, oddly enough, work hand in glove on a lot of this stuff. They appoint crooked judges, or certainly judges who have no qualifications, and whose rulings and decisions are extremely questionable. So as I say, in this area as in every other, we need radical change. You might think that the leading LGBT Democratic club in the city, the Stonewall Democrats of New York City, would support the queer Latina running against the heteronormative white woman. But who did the Stonewall Democrats endorse? They endorse the heteronormative white woman. Why? Because most of our openly gay elected officials are machine Democrats, including the two openly gay city council members in Queens. They might think of themselves as progressive and independent, but they're not. And so that's what we get. The leading, and the irony of the whole thing, this is what's really astonishing. They endorsed Melinda Katz over Tiffany Caban shortly after announcing a campaign to increase the number of openly LGBT members of the city council. Now, if there isn't a bizarre inconsistency or contradiction there, if not hypocrisy, in starting this campaign to try to increase the number of openly LGBT members of the city council while endorsing the heteronormative white woman over the queer Latina for Queens DA, I don't know what would be an inconsistency or a contradiction. And so within our community, within the LGBT community here in New York as well as nationally and internationally, we have to think very carefully. We have to engage in a very thorough and rigorous intersectional analysis. We have to be serious about advancing a progressive agenda, a progressive agenda informed by feminist values, I would argue, and hold leaders and organizations accountable. New York Times just reported today about Housing Works, which is an organization that serves people living with HIV/AIDS, especially with regard to housing. Housing Works, present executive director Charles King, is behind the scenes trying to quash an effort to unionize the staff. And this is someone who poses as a progressive, and yet he's anti-labor, and he's actually brought in strike-breaking anti-union lawyers. Think about that. To try to undermine attempts to unionize the staff of Housing Works. And this is someone who loves being arrested in demonstrations at City Hall and up in Albany at the state capitol. So we have to think about whether our leaders, not only elected officials, but community leaders, people who had organizations, are serious about what they do. My involvement with Palestine as an issue started because Glenda DeStone, obviously an out lesbian, the executive director of the LGBT Community Center of New York City, and here I'm putting community in air quotes, and the board of directors of the center expelled a Palestine solidarity group, banned not only Palestine solidarity organizing, but any discussion of Israel-Palestine for 2 years, based on absurd and frankly false pretexts. And it was only really through outside pressure. We formed New York City Queers Against Israeli Apartheid to end that moratorium, that ban, which, by the way, was instituted in part, no doubt, from pressure from the openly lesbian speaker of the city council, Christine Quinn. There's a whole, there are multiple layers here of hypocrisy and double dealing. And all too often, LGBT queer politics, like politics more general, ends up being a little bit like slicing an onion. You cry with every layer you cut through. There are a relatively small number of people in the LGBT community here in New York who are willing to speak out and who are actually truly independent. It's a small number. surprisingly enough, you might think otherwise, in blue New York City and state. And so these are things that we have to think about going forward. As I say, you know, it's really surprising to me that people are surprised that I do Palestine solidarity work as if it has nothing whatsoever to do with any of my other work. I see myself as a human rights activist who's pursuing an agenda of social justice and social change. So why wouldn't I be appalled by human rights violations in illegally occupied Palestine, which, by the way, include human rights violations against LGBT queer Palestinians? Why is that so distant from the activism that I do? That's what I find. I'm surprised that people are surprised, in a way.
Pauline, we just have a couple of minutes left. I'd love to hear a bit about Niagara.
Well, I co-founded Niagara back in June 1998, and the biggest thing that we've ever done was start and lead and the successful campaign for the transgender rights law enacted by the New York City Council. But Niagara is also a framework within which I've done hundreds of transgender sensitivity trainings, helping educate social service providers, healthcare providers, community-based organizations, government agencies, corporations. And so it's a framework for helping educate the public, because implementation is really as important as enactment. Getting an LGBT rights law enacted is important, but then making sure that it's fully and thoroughly implemented is just as important. And so the trainings that I do through Niagara are part of the process of implementing the law. And that is an ongoing process. In some ways, it frankly never stops. It's also about educating members of the community, the transgender community. There are a lot of transgender people who don't even know about the law in place, even though it's been in place since April 2002. Mm-hmm. And so public education of the LGBT community and the transgender community within it are a vital part of what I do through Niagara. I might also mention what I do through Queens Pride House is not only social services, but when I was executive director for 3 years, I also mounted an ongoing campaign of public policy advocacy and public education, hosting a number of forums, including the Palestine Forum, which is certainly the most controversial. But I also organized a forum on the human trafficking of Asian women in Queens, which no LGBT community center has ever done in this city. And maybe it took the first openly transgendered Asian American executive director of an LGBT community center to do so. I also organized two forums on public forums on policing, which is a hugely important issue. And I'm also representing both Niagara and Queens Pride House in a newly formed coalition, API coalition, Asian American Pacific Islander coalition, that's working on decriminalization of sex work, which is of vital importance to the transgender community, because here in New York, the NYPD assume if they read a trans woman as being transgendered, they will automatically assume she's engaged in sex work, whether she is or not. And so that has enormous implications for the health and the lives of trans people, especially trans women of color here in Queens, especially trans Latinas. And so that's another continuation of the work that I do both through Niagara and Queens Pride House. That's one formation. There are a number of others that are working on decriminalization of sex work, which is ultimately a state-level problem, because only through changing state law can we actually fully decriminalize sex work. Unfortunately, the city of New York is a creature of the state of New York, so city council legislation alone wouldn't be enough to effectuate that.
Pauline, thanks so much for joining us. It's been very lovely, and there's always a lot to learn from you and with you. So thank you.
Thank you, Alan. It was great being on again. I hope to be on another time.
You bet.
There's so much to talk about, and maybe next time we could get into talking about adoption and the Adoption Citizenship Act, and the really interesting and complicated politics, which have a very major LGBT queer aspect to them.
Let's do that soon.
Yes.
All right, this has been Preference Calculated. Conversation is up next, and thanks to Somia in the booth for making all of this happen. It's been a pleasure.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Hip Hop Halloween on Saturday, November 2nd from 9 p.m. to midnight at the Atlantis Lounge in Portland. Project Northwest and Arcadia Beats host Hip Hop Halloween